inevitable is now truly approaching the imminent. So we're experiencing ground rush before we hit the ground. It's not going to be pretty.
It's not going to be pretty. You mentioned technology. How does that play a factor?
Well, it's one of the two most important things concerning the ascent of man itself. In other words, what is it that's taken man from rooting for grubs and berries in the dirt to where we are today? Two things, basically, I think. Number one is the basic instinct on the part of people to produce more than they consume and save the difference. And in the relatively near term, I think World War III has already started. Or if we don't have an international nuclear war, we're going to have something resembling a real civil war in the US. That's possible. And a nuclear war doesn't have to be the only way the game is played. It could be a cyber war, because computers control everything today. Very likely it'll have a biological war aspect of it. That's possible too. But, these silly chimpanzees run around getting themselves into governments and go hooting and panting in other governments and fight with each other. But now the weapons we're using are really, really serious. All of these currencies are fiat units. They're all going to blow up. None of them are really worth anything. And they're all being printed up by the bushel basket by all these major governments, all of whom are bankrupt. So forget about the currency war. I'm more worried about a kinetic war. All of these countries are heavily armed.
Today, I've got an honorary guest. We've got the one and only Doug Casey, investor, author, truth teller. Doug is someone who's been calling out the cracks in the financial system for decades, teaching people how to educate, protect themselves. Doug, this is a special treat for me. It's like getting coffee with the Godfather. So, Doug, it's truly an honor to have you here.
Well, it's a pleasure, Steve. Thank you. And for me, at the moment, here is out on the farm in Uruguay near Punta del Este.
All right. Okay. What time is it there?
It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, thanks for your time, Doug.
That's great.
Doug,
it's nice
I want to
be here. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to jump right into it. You've long warned that endless money printing and runaway debt would push the financial system to a breaking point, whether through runaway inflation, defaults, or a serious hit to the U.S. dollar. You can only kick the can so far before it starts to unravel. Where are we right now? Is there a real crisis still ahead? Is a financial reset imminent? Are we already in the early innings? Where are we?
Well, as far as crying wolf about the collapse of the economy and indeed Western civilization itself, it's a question of what your timeline is, okay? And as an amateur historian, knowing where you've been is helpful to try to figure out where you may be going. So it seems to me that a lot of things have been in decline for some years. And at this point where we're talking now, things are accelerating. Let's say if we jumped off the top of a 100-story building in 1913, very bad year, was when they put into effect both the income tax and the central bank, the Federal Reserve. Things have been accelerating downhill since that time, notwithstanding the tremendous increases in technology and so forth, which is what's bailed things out. But at this point, I think we're inevitable is now truly approaching the imminent. So we're experiencing ground rush before we hit the ground. It's not going to be
It's not going to be pretty. No, you mentioned technology. How does that play a factor?
Well, it's one of the two most important things concerning the ascent of man itself. In other words, what is it that's taken man from rooting for grubs and berries in the dirt to where we are today? Two things, basically, I think. Number one is the basic instinct on the part of people to produce more than they consume and save the difference. That's how you grow real wealth. That's how you grow capital. And
Right.
the second thing is technology. We didn't we're doing have been doing this for 5,000 years of recorded history anyway, growing capital gradually, you know, 1/10% per year. But then with the blooming of the Industrial Revolution, which in many ways was a consequence of the unleashing of the powers of capitalism, it's all tied up actually. Technology has expanded things. So the ability of people to save and build wealth, build capital, and that capital is used to expand technology. And for the last several hundred years, technology has taken on a life of its own. So this is why, despite the fact that I have a reputation as a gloom and doomer, I think that ultimately, once again, it depends on your time frame. The future of mankind lies in the planets and maybe someday in the stars. So I'm an optimist against most common perceptions.
You're a realist.
I think I'm being realistic. Of course, there's also there's a significant possibility that the governments of the world are going to destroy everything in the form of a nuclear war. And in the relatively near term, I think World War III has already started. Or if we don't have an international nuclear war, we're going to have something resembling a real civil war in the US. That's possible. And a nuclear war doesn't have to be the only way the game is played. It could be a cyber war because computers control everything today. Very likely it'll have a biological war aspect of it. That's possible too. But you know, these silly chimpanzees run around getting themselves into governments and go hooting and panting in other governments and fight with each other. But now the weapons we're using are really, really serious. So there's cause for pessimism as well as optimism. Once again, time frame.
Doug, you mentioned World War III, and that's a big term. If you can kind of flesh that out for us a bit, what is that war? Who's that war with? I mean, I know that we've been in a currency war with, as Jim Rickards has been talking about for decades, that we've been in a war with China for a currency war for years. Tension seems to be popping up everywhere, not just with China. And you said we're already in World War III. Are we on the verge of it? Where are we exactly? And what's this war about? Nations, regions, ideologies, currency, what is it?
Well, take currency first, which you brought up. Currency is a device that governments use as money. And in a free market world, in a the kind of world I prefer to live in, there would be no currencies because currency is a government's substitute for actual money, and governments should not be in the money business. End of story.
Yeah.
That's something that should be left to the market. And that means that gold, almost certainly, now supplemented by Bitcoin, would be used as money. But we don't need dollars or euros or marks or yen. These are just confusing substitutes for real money. Okay, so forget about the currency war, okay? All of these currencies are fiat units. They're all going to blow up. None of them are really worth anything. And they're all being printed up by the bushel basket, by all these major governments, all of whom are bankrupt. So forget about the currency war. I'm more worried about a kinetic war. All of these countries are heavily armed, and especially now with the Trump regime in office. And it's funny. I don't believe in voting, of course, because as an anarcho-capitalist, I see government as being the enemy, the predator. Not something that I try to change and make it better because it's an innately corrupt and I'd say unnecessary institution. But forget about that tangent. I think that Trump, who I think would have been was vastly preferable over the communist-leaning Democrats and the horrible people they have running that party, is going off. He's going schizophrenic, asking the Europeans to spend from 2%, which they are now, on their de so-called defense budgets, raise it up to 5%. Who are they going to use those weapons against? Well, the Russians, but then maybe the Chinese. And that's all the world needs is a war with China and Russia. So this is actually insane what's going on in the world today. And it seems to have taken on a life of its own. So I'm in South America right now, and I like it down here for lots of reasons that we could discuss, but not least of them is the fact that the odds are significantly greater than zero that these people are going to start launching really destructive weapons at each other. Stupidly, there's no good reason for it any more than there was any good reason for World War I, or actually, and I know people will argue with this, World War II as well. But it's going to happen. War has not been banished.
So you're thinking weapons of mass destruction,
I
and
don't
you're
like to call them. I
thinking.
don't. Well, yeah, I don't like to call them weapons of mass destruction. You know, it used to be that they called so-called. There used to be something called ABC weapons, atomic, biological, chemical,
Okay.
because those three things are very destructive. But then they changed the words they were phrased in to weapons of mass destruction. Well, if you want a weapon of mass destruction, a fleet of B-52s is actually a weapon of mass destruction. So, anyway, I don't want to get into the weeds on the semantics of this thing, but yeah, there's a lot of really dangerous weapons that these guys are playing with today. For instance, in the news are two Russian weapons, a nuclear-powered cruise missile, which they say can orbit almost indefinitely, although it's only gone 13 hours so far, has unlimited range, and a nuclear-powered submarine, a torpedo, that can set off a zone bomb and create tsunamis off coasts, all kinds of weird things that are being worked on.
So what's this war about? Is it a bit over currency, power? I mean, is there, and what's the resolution? Or is it just, is it ho hopeless? I mean, we talked about being an optimist. Where's the optimism, Doug Casey, I'm hoping for?
No. Well, this too shall pass, of course. World War I was horrible while it lasted, and World War II was worse. And because the amount of wealth that can be disposed towards war, the number of people that are involved, the power of the state is much greater today. I mean, back, look, when World War II started, World War I or World War II, especially World War I, governments only controlled 5, maybe 10% of their national economies. Now, governments control 50% of national economies in many places, so they can utilize a lot more resources towards the destructive things that they do. And you'll excuse me for veering into something that looks like a political lecture, but politics, which I despise, on the one hand, is just the relation of people with each other. And we just don't seem to be able to get along, certainly not when we're organized politically, because politics is all about coercion and force and making people do things and extracting wealth from the people that produce it and giving it to useless mouths in exchange for votes. It's an essentially corrupt system. This is why, as I said before, I'm an anarchist. It's not going to solve the problems of the world because it's not going to solve the individual psychological aberrations that most of the 8 billion people on this planet suffer from. But it's better if they're not organized in big deadly groups called governments and nation states. But that's a philosophical statement. I'm not going to change the way the world works. I mean, unfortunately, all we can do is watch while these chimpanzees hoot and pant at each other and hopefully don't do too much damage in the next few years.
So let's talk about that, the government. I saw a meme the other day. It said the only thing scarier than the government shutting down is the government staying open. What do
Right.
you make of that? And is this shutdown a symptom of deeper systemic problems? And does it feel different this time? And should people be worried?
Well, the US government is manifestly bankrupt. Everybody's aware that the national debt is 37 or some trillion dollars, and that's the acknowledged debt. That's not counting undisclosed liabilities. It's not counting insurance payments that it has to make if the banking system pay all kinds of things like that.
Right.
So where is this money coming from? The people that pay all the taxes, the rich people, are already crowding in on the 50% level. The financial markets, as far as I'm concerned, are being held up by money printing and more debt. So I think we're actually on the edge of a precipice at this point. And I've been predicting that inevitably we were going to face something I call the Greater Depression. I call it the Greater Depression because it's going to be much worse and much different, and unfortunately, probably much more long-lasting than the unpleasantness of 1946 to 1929 to 1946. So I think we're looking at it right now. I don't know what the catalyst will be that will set this off. Would it be something getting out of control with Ukraine and Russia? Or will it be a startup of the dust up between Iran and Israel? Or I should say, between Israel and its lapdog, the US and Iran? Could anything happen? Could Trump possibly, as he's threatened to do, invade Nigeria to save Christians in the north of Nigeria? Or maybe he'll go to Darfur because, as a genuine genocide, nobody cares. Well, look, I can't do anything about genocides. This is part of the human fabric. But, that could be something else on his dance card. And of course, oh, Venezuela. He's looking to an looking to invade Venezuela on some basis, disguised by saying they're running fentanyl boats, which is a transparent lie. So there's a lot of chaos in the world, and it's not being confronted almost anywhere.
So, how does an average person like me protect, or how do we average people like me protect themselves? Is it by buying gold? I mean, what can we do to protect ourselves?
Well, first thing you can do is protect yourself. It's not by trying to change your political party or getting involved and convince your neighbors to do something or none of this. It's charity begins at home. So make sure that your own nest is well feathered. Make sure that you're out of debt, that you're living in a place where if the neighbors go wild, you won't be too adversely affected. So charity begins at home from that point of view. The way to do that,
Neighbors, Doug, by neighbors going wild, do you mean guns?
well, of course, every free man, in fact, historically, since ancient times, one of the major distinctions between a free man and a slave or a serf was the ability to defend yourself. And humans can't effectively defend themselves without weapons. So, yes, everybody should be adequately armed. There's no question about that. And people that are anti-guns are basically anti-tools and anti-human, and want you to rely on the state to defend you. Well, it's kind of crazy having an incompetent predator be your main defense. So yeah, of course, guns are wonderful, but they're just tools. Everybody should be familiar with how to use them and have the means to use them. Sure.
What about gold bullion? Is that fire insurance that everyone needs to be? Gold
Well,
stocks? Is that?
yeah, gold bullion. Bullion is primarily, as you know, available in 1 kilo bars or 100 ounce bars, 400 ounce bars if you're a government. So gold bullion itself is not a practical way to accumulate gold unless you keep it in an offshore storage facility, which incidentally is wise because as great as the financial risks are in the world today, political risks are even greater. Therefore, you should have a significant portion of your wealth outside of the bailiwick of your own government. That's where you keep gold bullion. I usually recommend, there are others that are, I think, fine, but I usually recommend SWP in the Cayman Islands as a place that you can store your gold bullion. But when it comes to gold, what you really want to own are gold coins, preferably small gold coins, which are more fungible. With gold at $4,000 an ounce, 1 ounce maple leaf or Krugerrand is big clunky coin, and if you attempt to cross a border with anything that looks a large gold coin, you probably will be stopped at the X-ray machine, and they will investigate it. That's just a fact. I can give you practical examples of this happening. So, you should buy your gold in sovereign size or quarter ounce size. They look like odd nickels and dimes as you carry them, but yes, you should own a lot of gold bullion, offshore and coins onshore.
Do you feel the same way about silver in terms of money? The U.S. Eagle silver coins, is that as fire insurance that everyone needs to be having in their own home?
Well, I often used to give out eagles or maple leaves when they were back at $4 to $5 an ounce, which they were in 1920, in 2001. But not at $50, quite frankly. I know Malcolm Forbes' famous quotation was, "My idea of social change is plenty of tens and twenties." Back when he said that, back when tens and twenties were, real, were worth something. But the answer to the question is, silver is really being demonetized, the way copper has been demonetized. It's primarily an industrial metal. It's a wonderful industrial metal. It's the reflective and the most conductive of all metals. So this is why it's used a great deal every year, unlike gold, which is basically saved or hoarded every year. But that's that. Yeah, I own a lot of silver, and it's kind of a poor man's gold. I think everybody should have some silver. It's more recognizable to the average guy than gold is. And since the average guy doesn't think, and maybe he's right, he doesn't have enough assets to buy significant gold, he'll go to silver. And since it's a much smaller market than gold, even though 10 times more silver is produced than gold every year, there's no inventories of silver, unlike gold. So it tends to be very volatile for that reason, that it's cheaper, much smaller market, no inventory. Yeah, I'm bullish on silver. I think we're going to see $200, $300 silver before this is over.
Do you have a timeline on that? I mean, when you say, are we talking by the end of this year, or are we talking like 5 years from now?
Well, you know what they say about predicting. If you give an event, don't give a time. Because if you
But
recognize, eventually everything happens.
eventually it'd be 500 or $200, $300 silver.
Eventually everything happens, including the heat death of the universe. So I hate to give a time, but you want to be buying the physical metals for prudence, for insurance, for safety, not so much for spectacular capital gains, because buying gold, and I've been a buyer of gold for 50 years. I sold an ounce, is the fact of the matter. But I'm not gold at $40 an ounce, or for that matter, in 2000 when it was 240. Actually, it was as cheap in 2001 as it was back in 1971 because of the debasement of the dollar. $240 was worth only $40 with that erosion of time. But the higher gold goes, the more you want to look at other alternatives to grow your wealth. And I'm continuing to buy gold as a savings vehicle because you've got to, where are you going to put your wealth, quite frankly? Where are you going to put your money? Put it in real estate. I don't want to put it in the stock market. The stock market's in a super bubble. I don't want to put any money in bonds, except as a speculation on interest rates, which I think are headed way up in the future. I don't know about the next year. But yeah, I continue to buy gold. But to speculate in gold, I mainly use mining stocks, frankly, because they are cyclically at one of their cheapest areas in history. Having watched mining stocks for about 50 years, over that 50-year period, there have been about five major bull markets in gold mining stocks. And what I mean major bull markets, I mean when the average small miner anyway went 10 to 1, some went to 100 to 1. I personally own a stock that went 1,000 to 1, which is a once in a lifetime event. But that was over a matter of a couple of years, not a lifetime. So I guess what I'm saying is that if you want to grow your wealth right now as a speculator, mining stocks are not for investors. It's a crappy industry, horrible industry. You can't invest in it. Maybe that's changing because of producing gold mining companies. All-in sustaining costs are about $1,500 an ounce, and gold is $4,000 an ounce. So actually, finally, owning a gold mine is once again like owning a gold mine. In the past, there were just liabilities. So look, things are constantly changing. But to answer the question, gold stocks are very, very underowned and very, very underpriced right now. And I think they have explosive upside potential, even though over the last year they've doubled or tripled as a group. But as volatile as they are, that's not a big deal.
So you've been a gold bull for decades, as you mentioned, and gold's had it an incredible run. And there's been dips in, here and there, but overall up. Do you see it going higher, or are we due for a correction? And as the monetary reset unfolds, what role do you see gold playing?
Well, I don't put much credence in most of the things that I read in the media. But one thing that I do believe, because it makes sense, is that for some years, the governments of the world have been buying gold. The retail public has not been buying gold, is not buying gold. There's lots of reasons I indicate that that's true. The higher gold prices in dollar terms have been coming from governments. Why? Because central banks have mostly owned US dollars for their assets. They don't want to own dollars anymore. They know it's the unsecured liability of another bankrupt government, which might do to them what they did to the Russians and cut off their ownings, or might make dollars untransferable, even if they still own them. So central banks have been getting rid of the hot potato called the dollar, and they've been buying gold. The Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, everybody has been buying gold. So that's why gold has gone up in dollar terms. And it's going to continue going up because the US government is on tilt. It's monetizing trillions of new dollars every year. So inflation is not going to stop unless we have a credit collapse. That's always an X factor, of course, if all the debt in the world starts to be defaulted on and they don't bail it out quickly enough. So, the answer to the question is gold is going higher, and eventually it's going to be remonetized. By that, I mean governments, because they don't and shouldn't trust each other, are not going to trade each other's phony baloney currencies. They're going to trade gold with each other. And that's only going to happen, I think, at much higher gold prices. And I think the US government is likely to unilaterally raise the price of gold to $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 an ounce, much in the manner of Roosevelt in 1934 or Nixon in 1971. And for the same reasons, it creates an asset in paper out of the same amount of gold.
So you see gold being used as a settlement asset between countries. Do you see gold-backed currencies again, even partially? I mean, is everything going to be tethered to the gold? I mean, are we going to see multiple reserve currencies? Are we going to not have currencies? And you mentioned that being, the U.S. dollar going to end up like, it sounds like is going to end up like toilet paper. Is it something that's, where are we going to lose the reserve status of the world status, or what's your thoughts on that?
The US dollar is definitely losing reserve status. It's by far the most heavily traded currency in the world today, priced in dollars. But the currency is being managed so irresponsibly that people don't want to use it for the reasons I mentioned before. But why would anybody trust the Chinese yuan or the Russian ruble? Or they're actually even sicker horses on the way to the slaughter yard. So it's going to go back to gold, and I don't believe in currencies. It's a foolish institution. You should use money, not currency, which is a government's substitute for money. You have to rely on a government, and governments are innately unreliable. So instead of speaking of a dollar, which is used to be just a 20th of an ounce of gold, and then a 35th of an ounce, and so forth, you should talk about grams of gold is what you pay for things with, just like you pay for things with Satoshis or Bitcoins. It's a unit. It doesn't stand for anything else. It is something in itself. So look, reality wins out eventually. And I think that's what's going to happen because gold is uniquely suited for use as money. It has been ever since Aristotle defined the five of the six reasons why it's an ideal money in the 4th century BC. Governments, Keynesian economics don't recognize that, don't acknowledge it, but it's true, it's going to happen.
They certainly seem to recognize that if they're dumping dollar for gold, they're printing US dollars, crap toilet paper to buy gold because they see that it's
Well, they don't like gold. These other governments don't like gold either because they all use their currencies to manipulate their populations and to buy the things they want. So they're just doing it because they don't want to be stuck with the US government's old maid card at this point, which they all own.
Is there a level where governments start to feel threatened by rising gold prices, or is this something that they like and expect and kind of manipulate, like you said, to reach certain numbers?
Well, when you have a rising gold price, just like rising prices in anything else, it destroys confidence in the currency. And the currency is like the stock of the government that issues it. And what people don't seem to understand is that governments come and go, they rise and fall. And when they fall, their currencies go with them. I mean, I have a wonderful collection of currencies which were issued and are totally worthless. I mean, in the US, we're familiar with the Confederate dollar, okay, but there are hundreds of them all over the world. And sad to say, I think that's going to happen to the US dollar. In fact, I'll go further. I think we're on the edge of a civil war in the US, and that's going to have real consequences for the economy. because the red people and the blue people in the United States just cannot even communicate with each other. They can't even communicate within the same family over Thanksgiving anymore. This is much more serious than what was going on in the 1960s when there was a bit of turmoil sociologically in the US. And I lived through it. And, it looked serious kind of at the time, but it came and went. But this is much more serious. I think the US is bound to start flying apart, frankly.
All right, so my first interview with Doug Casey, and we've already spoken about a World War III, a Greater Depression, and a Civil War. I love it. Now, is a Civil War something that's you see as imminent or something we're already in?
Well, it's like a lot of wars. They don't necessarily start with like Pearl Harbor, 1941. That wasn't really the start of World War II at all. It was a consequence of things that led up to that. So it's the same thing with the Civil War in the US. The thing is that the US isn't really a country anymore, sad to say. It's become a multinational domestic empire. In other words, even as far back as the 60s, when some of the first cracks really started showing, the US was a, frankly, a Christian white nation that shared traditions and values, and people were more or less on the same page with each other. Okay. It's different now. Part of this is actually turning into a race war. But is it a race war? No, it's really a culture war with a veneer of race on it, because most of the black people in the US, a lot of them anyway, have been totally corrupted by the welfare system and the education system, and they just happen to be black. So it's transformed into a black-white thing, not just a philosophical thing, because of how the black guy has been totally corrupted by the welfare and the education system. So, but it's a fact right now. And the immigration into the US, if you destabilize any system, if you were to it wouldn't matter if you if well, it's happening in Japan right now, for instance. There are thousands of Africans that are being migrated to Japan. The average Japanese is barely aware of this, but they're becoming aware of it. And especially in a tight-knit society like Japan, they have everything, language, traditions, everything. I mean, it was one of the most tight-knit countries in the world. But for some odd reason, there are thousands of Africans being migrated to Japan. This is asking for trouble. It's setting off a time bomb. Listen, you can say what you want about racism and oh, it's ugly and it's bad and all right, but the fact is that birds of a feather flock together, and the first identifier of an alien, a stranger, and we're genetically programmed to be wary of strangers. How do you tell it's a stranger? They talk different, they act different, they dress different, but they look different than you do. And from the days when, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, strangers equal danger. So I'm all for immigration, incidentally. I really am. But massive immigration is destabilizing. And when things become unstable, they can become chaotic and dangerous. And this is happening all over the world. It's not just Japan, it's happening in Ireland. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in lots of places in the world, including the US. Like, what were 200,000 Somalis doing being imported to Minneapolis, also Portland, Maine? What sense did that make? I'd say absolutely none. They're not self-sustaining, especially true when they're of an alien religion. So, look, I don't want to sound like Nick Fuentes, who I have nothing against. I listened to that interview with Tucker, which is very famous and actually infamous now. And many of the things he says are sensible, although they are very unpolitically incorrect. And I don't think Fuentes is a libertarian, which complicates things a little bit, because as a libertarian anarchist, of course, a lot of things that I'm saying sound out of context, because I don't choose my friends by their economic status, although that's an element. I don't choose them by their race, although that could be an element. I choose them by their character. Like, that was probably the most sensible thing. And he said other sensible things that Martin Luther King said. It's the content of your character, their belief, what goes on in their mind. That's how I choose my friends. And that's how everybody ought to choose their friends. But unfortunately, we don't live in that world today. Have I been too confusing in going on this little rant?
No, Doug, I find this fascinating. A lot of moving parts and trying to understand. I mean, it is a chaotic world, and the war between blue and red certainly, it seems to be pretty apparent that it's becoming more and more divisive. I mean, every election it seems very polarizing. I mean, you've got every issue there's always something to divide over, whether it's politics or race or whatever. And that kind of brings me to the next point of you mentioned in the past globalism, the death of globalism, big nation states disintegrating over time. I'm curious as to know how this may be related, and is the global economy going the way of the dodo? I mean, are we seeing that happening now? Is the world becoming more regionalized, and how do you see the map being redrawn? What major blocks emerge, and who comes out ahead?
Yeah, well, ideally, I'd like to see, instead of roughly 200 nation states in the world, I'd like to see about 8 billion nation states in the world, so that
Interesting.
every individual on the planet was in control of his own reality, not being controlled by some central authority in a capital city. So let me preface what I'm saying by that. But although the so-called globalists apparently want to have a one-world government where the UN or something like that controls and makes rules for the whole world, that's what they want, where the elite can be on top because they know best and so forth, like the World Economic Forum, which I think is busting up as we speak. Or the European Union, which started out as a means to get rid of tariffs between countries. Good idea. And allow free travel between Europeans. Good idea. But then it's turned into a Frankenstein's monster where it's trying to regulate and control absolutely everything. The European Union is going to bust up. And then a lot of the countries within the European Union are probably going to bust up. I don't doubt that Italy, which people forget, was dozens of little principalities up until Garibaldi in the 1850s. It could happen again. People forgot that Germany used to be a bunch of little baronies and principalities up until Bismarck in 1870, dozens of them. And then it was united. That wasn't a good idea. I mean, dozens of little Liechtensteins and Hesses weren't a problem. Put them together in Germany with the maniac, of which Bismarck was the first, bad idea. So a lot of these, even European countries, are going to break up. And most of the countries in the global South, the third world, are not real constructs. They're artificial. They were created artificially in Europe with no relation at all to the ethnicity or language or culture of the people that were there. They're going to break up. Africa is going to become a giant war zone for that reason. Even South America is going to break up. I mean, Brazil, it's going to turn into at least two, maybe three, maybe more countries in the future, mainly on ethnic lines and also economic lines. Bolivia, it's likely to break up into at least two, probably three different countries, the highland Indians and the lowland Europeans, who don't get along very well, incidentally. And all through South America, this idea of a kind of a Reconquista, where Indians, after 500 years, are again resenting their Spanish conquerors. I mean, this is amazing. After hundreds of years, these fault lines are coming out. So I think all over the world, we're going to see this type of thing happening. Meanwhile, these governments try to hold things together. I mean, that's what a civil war is about, where two or more groups try to take control of the same government. So the Civil War, so-called in the US from 1861 to 1865, that was not a civil war. It was a war of secession, a different thing. This time we're going to have probably a civil war and war of secession combined, which is more like the American Revolutionary War, which was actually both things. So,
Doug, is that why you don't live in the States?
well, I like the States. I'm an American. I've always been a fan of muscle cars and California girls and the Beach Boys and drive-ins and all the good things that the US has that make it kind of unique. I love the US, but the US is changing, has changed right before our very eyes. And as I said, I think I said before, it's turned into a multicultural domestic empire. And empires, especially if they're they're all multicultural, are never stable. So that's what's happened to the US. And it's too bad. But I see the US not as a geographical entity so much. I see America as an idea. And it was actually the best political idea that's ever been hatched, ever, anywhere, better than Athens. Century BC.
What makes that so?
Because it was the only country in the world's history that was founded on the idea of individuality and personal freedom and capitalism and limited government, things of that nature. The only one ever that was founded on that basis. The rest of them evolved, better or worse, in different directions. But the US was founded on on that principle. But those principles have been washed away pretty much in lots of ways. It's been washed away in every way, economically and financially and demographically and every way. So it's much as I love the idea of America and still like the US, the political entity, it's on the slippery slope,
Doug,
accelerating
you've been
rapidly.
all, yeah. Tell me about it. You've been around the world, and you travel a lot. I know you've been pretty much everywhere. Like, where do you think is probably the best place to live right now, both for stability and opportunity? I mean, I don't know. It's hard to name a country that's not at war at this point or in danger of war. So, in terms of stability and opportunity, where would you? What are some of your favorite places?
Well, I'm talking to you now from my farm in Uruguay, which I think is the most stable country in Latin America, frankly. And stable and nice, peaceful, prosperous. I'm a fan of Uruguay, and I'm a fan of living on farms too, frankly. I'm a fan of Argentina. I've been a premature bull on Argentina for a long time.
Okay.
Long time. Finally was right when they elected Javier Milei, because things got so stupid and so bad, they were willing to try anything. So they elected a self-declared anarcho-capitalist. He's done great things. I'm afraid he's losing the straight and narrow path at this point. I'm very disappointed in many of the things Milei has done. But in the recent elections, like last week or something, he did quite well. So maybe he's going to redouble his efforts, notwithstanding many of the stupid things that he's done, which we could discuss. So Argentina, Uruguay, those are two definite places. I've lived in 10 countries. I've been to 160 or something. But I'm a for the long-term future, I'm a big fan of the Orient. I really am.
What's the Orient?
Well, we're talking China, Japan, Southeast Asia. Not so much India. But China, Japan, Korea, East Asia is, I think, where it's at. They're unafflicted by most of the stupid ideas that have conquered the West. What it's worth, and it's hard to say what it's worth, but the average IQ in the Orient is 5 or so percentage points above what it is in the West. And we don't even need to talk about the rest of the globe.
I'm not touching that
Want to touch that one. The values and the culture are good. I mean, they've adopted many of the best parts of America. Not all of them, not enough of them, but and I like the Orient. It's a great place to live, even as a Guaylo like myself. I mean, I lived in Hong Kong and Thailand for years, and was great. But of course, if you migrated, 50 million Americans to it wouldn't work out. It wouldn't work out. But individuals that transfer that move because they want to improve themselves and they want to bring something to the local culture, sometimes that's only interesting foreign restaurants. I'm all for it. That's great. Bringing in hundreds of thousands of aliens who are supported by the Commonweal, well, no way in hell the Chinese are ever going to do that. Or the
Doug, I
Vietnamese,
want to
even if the Vietnamese, even the Japanese are starting to do it now. Strange. But anyway.
Doug, I want to shift gears just a bit. I did buy your new book. It's if I can't show here you. Well, it's not coming up very well. There it is. Don't
Oh, I
move.
had one here
So
myself.
I got a new book, Doug Casey, the Preparation, How to Become Competent, Confident, and Dangerous. It's co-written with your friend Matt Smith and his son Maxim, I believe. Can you tell us a bit about your co-authors, why you wrote it, who you had in mind, and what you hope your readers would take away?
Well, for years, I've talked about a book that would direct young men who are pretty lost in today's world, especially in the West, as to what they should do. They've been totally corrupted by the education system, by the entertainment society, by almost everything. And they're lost. They're all turning into cucks and nobodies and losers. So the idea that I had was to direct them so that instead of idiotically going from high school to college, which people thought was a ticket to a good life, which is bullshit, it's not. It just burdens you with debt you can't dismiss and clutters your mind up with poisonous ideas. Horrible. It's not what it used to be in the days of Mr. Chips, okay? So the idea of this book was to provide guidance to how to become a Renaissance man. In other words, somebody who can, if dropped into the Congo with nothing but the clothes on his back, could survive and prosper. Because you have the knowledge, you have the abilities, and you have the wherewithal, moral and certain psychological. How do you acquire these things? Okay, it's not in the current paradigm. So this book talks about what to do during those 4 years between 18 and 22, which are arguably the most important years of a young man's life. Where he should go, exactly what he should do, exactly what he should read, what courses he should take. And the idea is at the end of that time, you should be able to everything from after spending 3 months taking Muay Thai in Thailand. It's not the only place, but it's a good start. Excellent. To learning to drive heavy equipment, to learning to scuba dive for fun, learn to skydive, all kinds of things instead of sitting in back of a desk listening to some dried professor lecture at you the same dumb speech he's given, full of bullshit for the last 20 years, a great expense. So this is the whole idea, to become dangerous and confident and competent is what this book will guide you to do. And I think that the most important takeaway that anybody listening to our conversation is buy the damn book, read it, and give it to your son or grandson, and try to transform his life so he doesn't need to be flushed down the coming toilet.
Doug, as a parent, I mean, I wish I had this book when I was young, first of all. And
Oh,
my
me too.
wife and I
Me
often,
too. It didn't exist.
Thank you. So thank you for writing it. My wife and I often clash about, our kids, going in college. I'm not a believer in the ROI, just doesn't seem to be there. My friend Andy met you in the early 1990s. And at that time, he was a young man looking for advice. And he said that you told him, one, invest in gold, two, learn Spanish, maybe Chinese, and three, live in or invest in Latin America. I forget what exactly, but he said your advice was spot on, especially about gold. Now, if a young person, say, between the age of 18 and 22, were listening today, and what advice would you give them here?
Don't go to college. Deploy that time and money in some places vastly more productive, because going to college, unless you're serious and you're taking STEM courses, okay, I can understand that. That's a different situation. But don't misallocate that time and money. You're never going to get it back. So that's number one. And as far as the other things that Andy said, I think that learning Spanish is a very important language. My Spanish is, I'm not a good linguist. I get by okay in Spanish. My French is still much better than my Spanish because I learned it when I was young, which is important. But I wish I could have learned Chinese, although most Chinese actually speak English as a second language today. That's important to have skills. And I used to say, in addition to South America, Africa, because you go to Africa, I don't like level playing fields. I like playing fields that are tilted to my advantage. And if you go to Africa, which is terra incognita for almost everybody, they're afraid of it. You can bring things to Africa that they don't have by virtue of having grown up wealthy and educated and connected and all this. So the Africans are anxious to meet you. So I've met all these presidents of dogshit countries because nobody goes there except for me. And so opportunity is there. It's good for the locals in Africa and a lot more opportunity for you because you're on the high ground. So I'd add that to what Andy said. Otherwise, it was a perfect recantation of what I believe I told him then.
Well, he said you were spot on, and he said he benefited quite a bit. So I'm hoping that other people listening can benefit from this show as well as from your book, The Preparation. I'm going through it. I'm enjoying it. So thank you for writing that. Doug, for anyone who wants to follow you, reach out, learn from you, what's the best way?
Well, go to internationalman.com. It's a free blog we have. We have great writers every day, including myself, I gotta say. And it's free, and everybody should subscribe to it. It's just great. Number one. Number two, I do a podcast with Matt Smith, usually once or twice a week. And it's pretty good, frankly. It's on YouTube. So, Doug Casey's Take. Excuse me. Number three, we have a newsletter, crisisinvesting.com. So I think that's good if you're interested in investment stuff. Number four is my novels, because there's a lot of things you can say in the form of fiction that perhaps are best left unsaid in nonfiction form. And so the three we've done so far, John Hunt and I, are Speculator, about a bush war in Africa and a gold mining fraud. And then he becomes a drug dealer, just number two. Number three, he becomes an assassin. And there are four more, and they're all more radical than the next one. They're on Amazon, and I think you'll be mightily entertained and educated by those books as they reform highly in politically incorrect and unjustly besmirched occupations.
Doug, that doesn't sound like you at all. Doug, it's truly an honor to have you here. I know you're a busy man, and I'm grateful for your time. For everyone listening, I'll include Doug's links in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in. I'm just Steve Yang, learning with you from people smarter than me. Stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. And Doug, thank you again so much for your time.
Pleasure talking with you, Steve.